Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC, our politics website, itsafreecountry.org, is now the place for smart coverage of the 2012 presidential race. Right now on the site, why Michelle Bachmann might have been the Iowa winner of the New Hampshire debate the other night. 2012 is starting now at itsafreecountry.org. Maybe saw this front page story in the New York Times on Sunday with this lead. The Obama administration is leading a global effort to deploy shadow internet and mobile phone systems that dissidents can use to undermine repressive governments that seek to silence them by censoring or shutting down telecommunications networks. The article describes a widespread technology liberation movement, an internet in a suitcase project, and stealth wireless networks. Sounds cool, but is it also kind of dicey for the U.S. government to assert itself in this way and undermine autocratic regimes with which we have complex diplomatic relationships? And is it really our business? James Glanz, the New York Times investigative reporter who co-wrote the article with John Markoff, joins me now, as well as Clay Shirky, NYU professor and author of the books Here Comes Everybody and Cognitive Surplus. Welcome back, both of you, to WNYC.
Good morning.
Thanks so much.
James, what's a shadow internet, a stealth wireless network, and the internet in a suitcase? Are these all of a piece?
Well, the basic idea is that you may not want to communicate in a way that can be monitored by, you know, the government. And the telecommunications network in a lot of these repressive places, in fact, we found virtually all of them, is controlled by the government. It was basically set up so that it could be monitored or shut down, you know, at basically a moment's notice. And so these, when you say shadow or stealth internet, wireless services, it means that you can communicate, you know, person A to person B to person C without going through that main telecommunications hub. You set up your own sort of tailor-made network, you might say.
And you wrote that the movement has picked up momentum since Hosni Mubarak's regime shut down the Egyptian internet in the final days of his rule. Was a shadow internet in use in Egypt at that time?
No, and people found that that was a real shame if they wanted to communicate when the Mubarak regime decided they should not communicate. Some people found ways around it using corporate fiber optics or satellite connections, but it was sort of onesie-twosie. This is a more formalized effort.
Clay, you are steeped in all things internet, and you pay particular attention to the ways that communication technology is used to organize people for political and social change. So do you see a coherent liberation technology movement sweeping the globe? I love all these phrases. It's like it's all right out of a spy movie.
Yeah, well, it is all right out of a spy movie, and I think that's in a way part of the problem. There's a distinction to be drawn that I think is implicit in the article, in Glanz and Markoff's article, that I wish was a little clearer, which is that there's some communications tools that are useful for civil society, and there's some communications tools that are useful for civil war. And that in a lot of these cases, although the rhetoric is about free speech and democracy, we're really talking about weaponizing communications networks for people in civil war, right? This is for Libyans in the outskirts of Misrata kind of stuff. And I think the linking of these tools with the broader goals of free speech and democracy promotion is actually a mistake. And they quoted me saying basically as much in the article, because those are different kinds of goals. Free speech in a society that strengthens civil society just in the sort of ordinary course of people going about their lives is one set of goals. And helping insurgents communicate in the face of repressive regimes is a different and more warlike set of goals.
James, what do you think about that distinction between technology for civil society and for civil war?
Yeah, well, Professor, we didn't cover the politics as heavily as we did the technology, so they gave us the number of words we had.
Fair enough.
But, you know, I would say that people are already finding ways to do this. In Iran, we understand people use Bluetooth as a way of passing subversive material from one cell phone to the next. People may be familiar with Bump, which is a way of doing it here with business cards and things like that. And this is a way of kind of making that writing that movement large. You know, I mean, if I'm going out tonight with my friends Mark and Zuzia for dinner, if I don't care that the government knows that, I can phone them and text them as I did earlier. See you later. You know, if I don't want them to know that, it might be a million reasons I don't. This is a way of circumventing the central government and allowing me to do that, sort of a in defense of free speech kind of thing. It may not always be for political reasons. So I think how that debate plays out is yet to be seen, and I don't think it's – I wouldn't quite call it weaponizing. I think it's kind of a strong term.
Listeners, we have a few minutes if you have questions about the shadow internet or the technology liberation movement and the U.S. government's place in it. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or use your own New Media Liberation Movement and post your comment to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. 212-433-WNYC on the phone, 212-433-9692 for Clay Shirky from NYU and James Glantz from The New York Times, who wrote this up. Let's take the Afghanistan example. The U.S. is creating a parallel cell phone network, according to the article, because the Taliban can shut off the other one. So, Clay, I guess you would say that's more about fighting the war than it is about freedom of speech. But isn't it really both?
That is an interesting edge case. But that is a place where the attempt to build a civil society is itself part of the oppositional, you know, part of the oppositional struggle between the United States and the Taliban over
war goal.
Over governance of Afghanistan. But there, each side is laying claim to legitimacy as, you know, essentially as the sort of governing power of the region. The place where you're building visible parallel infrastructure is a way of saying we're going to try and densify civil society in Afghanistan. That is different, I think, from building hidden infrastructure that's trying to, as you know, as Mr. Glantz said, is trying to circumvent the goals of the central government. In this case, the United States is trying to be the central government, but I think that it's clearly still it is a move in the larger war going on with the Taliban rather than, you know, it's sort of an ordinary civil construction effort.
You were also quoted in the article saying the State Department could be exposed to charges of hypocrisy if it maintains support for autocratic governments in, say, Saudi Arabia or Bahrain while deploying technologies that undermine them. The stakes are really high here. Are they trying to have it both ways, standing for freedom and democracy but unwilling to sever diplomatic and economic relationships? Or is that, you know, too fine a way to slice it?
Well, I don't think it's too fine a way to slice it. I mean, states' dilemma is permanent in this regard, right? We are the superpower. Everybody has to have a bilateral relationship with us. And also, we are on the side of democracy, at least rhetorically. And so we're going to get tripped up every place we have to deal with an autocratic regime. What I think is happening now is that as particularly in the Middle East and North Africa, when they saw that we threw Mubarak under the bus in less than 2 weeks' time, suddenly the autocrats in that region are starting to think the U.S. will abandon us if a successful insurgent movement develops. In that context, I think attempting to portray freedom of speech as a kind of neutral human right is doomed not merely to fail, but potentially to expose us to worse criticism than if we just said, look, we're building this because we have a pro-democratic bias.
And James, did you get any response maybe from people in other countries along the lines of what right does the United States have? A lot of our listeners may be cheering the idea of technology that's going to promote human rights and free speech. But on the other hand, people may have a reaction to this like, wait, the United States has a right to go into other countries and undermine their communications laws?
You know, there are remarkably few citizens of this planet who don't want to have a functioning cell phone or internet connection. And if it doesn't go through the central government's hub, I don't think they really give a rip, to tell you the truth. And, you know, I'm sure there are people who have vested interests, government interests, for example, in these countries who are pretty much shaking in their boots, but they didn't write to me, Brian. And I think they'll sort of stand pat and keep going with the sort of game they've been playing, which is that countries like China kind of try to keep ahead of these sorts of movements by developing better firewall software, better monitoring techniques. And it's really a race here between two horses. One is freedom of expression and all of the things that Professor Shirky points out are the consequences of that. And then you have the governments with their vested interest. And so I think you're just going to see this play out. I think everybody understands the game at this point, and this is a new element in that contest.
Caller from West Point. David, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Right. If you can do that overseas, why can't the Taliban or any terrorist organization do that on our soil?
Well, presumably they're already trying, Clay, aren't they?
Yeah. In fact, the great digital technologies tend to be neutrally available. At least consumer technologies tend to be neutrally available to people, and the Taliban will, of course, try to do that. I mean, the Taliban won't do it here, but terrorist networks do it here, whether homegrown
presumably,
or imported.
I think what he's saying is, if we do this over there, then it's going to help enable them to do it over here,
or say that it's
somehow okay because we're doing it over there. But I would presume that groups like that are trying to do it here, whether we do it there or not. James?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, we have a much more open system here, so, you know, you can communicate pretty freely here. Now, if you want to set up your own network, I mean, people have local wireless networks and things like that. We just don't quite fear that as much here.
Right.
And it's a different kind of
this
society.
Because this isn't really about jamming the networks in other countries. This is about creating other ways to communicate.
Yeah, that's right.
Lisa in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to point out something similar, which is that the use of this technology can be applied in almost any way, and that we cannot assume that it will be used for a pacific and peaceful application, but it could be used in any way. Also, this is formed in some ideological construct that disturbs me, that we have the right to determine what is good for other places. We have the right to use technology when we think it's good. And what gives us this sort of moral precept that guides us in these decisions?
So, Lisa, an argument on the other side of that could be more free speech, more ability for citizens to communicate with other citizens is a universal right and should be seen that way. So what's wrong with it?
What's wrong with that? I, of course, love free speech. My whole life is based on free speech. But free speech, as most people do not want to realize, is not unfettered speech. It can be used for deleterious purposes, for harmful purposes, and internet free speech is permanent. You cannot correct mistakes. You cannot correct libelous speech very easily. And as Carl Sandburg once wrote, you know, big words use wear big boots, and you get kicked in the butt with a big boot, you better be careful. So I would say that the notion of free speech being unlimited is not the reality of what happens in society.
Thank you. Clay, are you worried about that? Could this be undermined?
I'm not worried about that because I think that we have historical precedent going back 500 years that when we open up the number of participants in public discourse, societies essentially become more representative, right? Certainly the printing press was used to print Mein Kampf. You can lay a lot of really horrible literature that's come out of the printing press of the world, and yet I'm willing to go on record as saying printing press, pretty good.
Okay, we've settled that controversy, I think. So as we run out of time, James Glantz from the New York Times, are other governments supporting these kinds of initiatives around the world? Is France, is Britain, do they consider this their business, or is this uniquely a U.S., quote-unquote, empire thing?
It's a worldwide movement. I would say, though, it's really led more by these people in this liberation technology movement than it is by individual governments. You know, I talk with, for example, a developer in Vienna who set up one of these mesh networks, kind of like the one we're talking about, as a pilot project there, Aaron Kaplan. And he'll contribute to the project in the United States. So there's a kind of an interest among, what you might say, it sounds naive, but I'll say the citizens of the globe, to make this kind of thing work, whether governments get involved or not.
Yeah, but you said $70 million in your article, right, by the end of this year.
Yeah, it's a wide range of technologies. Some of them are just what we're talking about. Some are sort of related to it, but that's the State Department's kick into this.
Clay, last word.
Just wanted to say, speaking as a techie, we also have to be really careful about the difference between what people claim a technology is going to do and what it actually does. And so while Glantz and Markov studied a bunch of really interesting tools, we haven't seen internet in a suitcase working yet. And so we have to be careful about not extrapolating based on claims of what it's going to do until we see it in the field.
A shadow internet, shadow mobile networks, the technology liberation movement, as written up by James Glantz and John Markoff in the New York Times over the weekend. James, thank you. And Clay Shirky, NYU professor, author of Here Comes Everybody and Cognitive Surplus, thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay with us. We will sample from a new film that tracks the legendary Manhattan Sex Crimes Unit. Stay with us.